It's business time, baby.
You are listening to Solo Monster Sounds Off.
It's such good shit.
Mama Monster.
Conquered! Oh!
You like fighting a woman?
You got grown-ass wrestlers in the back going on Twitter.
Come over here and fight me.
Don't speak, bitch. Come on now.
You have legs.
They've made Solo a monster.
I was 99% positive it was just chest up.
No.
I want out of my contract if I don't get what I want.
Welcome to episode 874. Of the Solo Monster Sounds Off. It is Sunday, August 11th, 2024. I am the Solo Monster. One PLE down for this month. SummerSlam is in the books. We have two more to go. We have All in Wembley coming up in a few weeks. And then Bash in Berlin to close out the month. So two more big events coming up. We're almost at the midway point here in August. I want to thank you so far for all of your support this month. Let's keep it going. Thank you to our PayPal producers. You can always make a donation on thesolomonster.com. You'll see the link at the top of the page. Thank you to Big B, Brian Becerra, the Diamond Dallas Dance Machine, Harrison Soet, Velvet Revolver, Robert Murray, Iowan Corn Farmer, Jesse Lamphere, the Portland Pop Star, Paul Hamilton, the Chicago Slayer, Willie Eicher, Night Stalker, Naif Al-Safar, Daredevil, Doug Lippert, Best in the Game, Trey Porter, Killshot, Keith Hart, Big Homie, John Burton, cheers, my friend, and Show Your Role, Chris Ludak. Don't forget to check out his new YouTube series, What Could Have Been in Wrestling. Just search for Chris Ludak, it's Ludecke, and What Could Have Been in Wrestling. It's got some good content up there, so check it out. Also, if you're looking for a new book to listen to, we, of course, have our Audible link, which is active right now. audibletrial.com/solomonster. You got some good choices up there. Jim Ross, of course, has his new book. For those who don't know, he's got another book that came out recently. Business is about to pick up. Becky Lynch's book is up there. John Moxley's book. You've got Guy Evans, his Nitro book. All of that and more are available, and you can get at least one for free when you use our link to sign up for a 30-day trial of the Audible service. If you are an Amazon Prime member, you can actually cash in two free books. You got to use our link, audibletrial.com/solomonster. Go ahead and take advantage of that. Got a bunch of WWE stuff to get into here, some AEW stuff as well, and a bunch, and when I say a bunch, I mean a metric ton of questions, mainly gold, silver, and bronze in the mailbag later on, in the spirit of the Olympics, which is concluding tonight. So we will get to all that, but we have to begin with some sad news. On Friday morning, the news broke that the Taskmaster, Kevin Sullivan, who was a mainstay in the Florida wrestling scene, later on in WCW as well, both in the ring and behind the scenes, passed away at the age of 75. And he was in poor health the last few months after suffering what his family described as a devastating accident during an autograph signing. That was back in May. And he underwent emergency surgery to save his leg. They saved his life. He ended up getting sepsis and encephalitis, which is an inflammation of the brain. I remember years ago here in New York, they used to have airplanes flying overhead here, spraying for mosquitoes because people were contracting encephalitis from mosquito bites. He was in and out of the ICU. His family set up a GoFundMe that raised over $50,000 to help with his medical expenses. They said he had great insurance, but it didn't take long for that coverage to be wiped out because of how long of a stay he had in the hospital. I mean, that could bankrupt you very quickly in this country. Lots of people donated. I know Tony Khan dropped $10,000. Jim Cornette dropped $5,000. Chris Jericho, Mick Foley, Cody Rhodes, DDP. He had a lot of people in his corner cheering him on. And a lot of fans in terms of other wrestlers who learned a lot from him, liked him, knew him, worked with him or for him in some way. But in the end, it wasn't enough. WWE acknowledged his passing on its website and with a video on SmackDown on Friday night. I would imagine that video will play during Raw this Monday as well. He was never the biggest, most physically imposing guy. Yeah, he was only 5'9". Superstar Billy Graham once said that Blackjack Mulligan, when he would work with Sullivan, would have to get down on his knees, and he was still taller than Kevin Sullivan was. But he was believable. He was believable, especially in those early days of his career. He worked really well with the bigger guys. He never had a proper run in WWE, although he did work enhancement matches there in the mid-70s for a couple of years. Probably about 2 or 3 years. I mean, him being an East Coast guy, and I mean, you just listen to him speak and you could tell right away where he's from. You could tell, okay, that's a New England guy right there. But him being an East Coast guy, I would be very surprised if he didn't work at least a few matches for WWE back then. But it was always at the lower end of the card. Where he found his first real success was championship wrestling from Florida. He was the Prince of Darkness, Kevin Sullivan. He was a satanic cult leader with his Army of Darkness. And he really tapped into that whole satanic panic of the 1980s. Nancy, his wife, or who would later become his wife, was part of that group. She would go on to simply become known as Woman. And, of course, in WCW, he became the leader of the Dungeon of Doom, which was responsible for some of the worst television that you will ever see. I'm sorry, it was awful. If you were a wrestling fan back then, mid-90s, WCW, you know exactly what I'm talking about. Very lame, very cheesy, you know, probably very on brand for wrestling at that time. The Dungeon of Doom is something that would have worked in, you know, early 90s WWF. And they mainly served as foils for Hulk Hogan to beat. You know, when they brought Hogan in 94 and gave him that ticker tape parade and made him the champion, Hogan wanted big guys that he could beat. And that's what Sullivan gave him. That's what the Dungeon of Doom was. Although it did give us the unintentionally hilarious moment where Hogan is transported. Yeah, I talk about Lucha Underground, right? Cinematic, and it was ahead of its time in many ways. Well, the Dungeon of Doom gave us some cinema of its own, and there was one unintentionally hilarious moment where Hogan is transported to their evil lair. He doesn't know where he is, and he sees a water fountain, and he touches the water, and then he pulls back and he shouts, "It's not hot!" That still lives rent-free in my head. Like, I can understand shouting, "It's hot," but to shout, "It's not hot," I never understood that. But the Dungeon of Doom, it also gave us the debut of the Giant. And I think that guy went on to do some things in the business. The thing is, as cheesy as so much of this was, Sullivan still got to feud with Hulk Hogan. And Hulk Hogan was still the biggest name in the business at that time. You know, he was Hogan's top nemesis for a while there. So it was not a bad spot for him to be in. He even got to have a match with Mr. T. Starrcade 94, the same show where a young Triple H made his one and only WCW pay-per-view appearance. Not long after that, he left for WWE. But yes, Kevin Sullivan actually had a match. It was terrible. It was not good. It was short. So that's maybe the best part about it. But he had a match with Mr. T. Later on, the Dungeon of Doom went on to feud with the Four Horsemen. And that is what gave us the infamous strap match with Brian Pillman, where the winner would have to tell the other man that he respects them. Not 60 seconds into the match, Pillman grabs the microphone away from the referee and says, "I respect you, Booker man," and he leaves the ring. Now, this was at a time when Pillman was starting to work the loose cannon gimmick, and Sullivan was booking, or he was helping out with the booking behind the scenes, hence the Booker man line. And it made for an awkward moment because the announcers wouldn't acknowledge that part of what he said, and it made no sense that he would give up so easily, and then he would just walk out. But boy, did it get people talking, which was the whole point. So Sullivan has claimed he was in on it. Bischoff would have had to have been in on it. I mean, Bischoff ended up working him into a firing so that he could leave and go somewhere else to make the angle more believable. So I can't imagine that Bischoff was not clued in, and they may have been the only ones. And so not only did he kind of work Bischoff into giving him a release so that he could go show up in ECW and he can, you know, make things a lot more legitimate looking, he ended up making a deal to go work for Vince McMahon. Now, Bischoff will say that it was all part of the plan, and he kept in contact every week with Pillman the whole time that he worked for WWE. You know, what's true and what's not, we'll never know for sure, because I don't trust everything that comes out of Eric Bischoff's mouth. I always just love the idea that he had lawyers at Turner draw up real termination papers for Pillman to make it more legitimate, which he then took for real and used to sign a deal with Vince. So, I mean, whatever you believe, a lot of the talent thought it was real. You know, what happened in the match with Sullivan? Sullivan said one of the best compliments he ever got in his life was from Kevin Nash when Nash was still working for WWE. And he told Sullivan, and I don't know when he told him this, he might have told him this after, because it was the same year that he went to go work there. But he told Sullivan a bunch of the boys on their roster bought the pay-per-view after, I guess the replay, to see the shoot, or what they thought was a shoot. See, that's when you know you got them. When you can convince your own peers that it must be real, then you got them. But he said it was all Brian's idea. You know, he always, in any shoot interview I've ever seen him do, he always gave Pillman credit for the idea. Pillman was something else, man. I mean, you know, also like Sullivan, he was an undersized guy in a big man's business. And he had a ceiling where he was, you know, before when he was flying Brian. He's very talented, but he was only going to go so far in that company. And he knew that. He knew he had to change it up and do something to get noticed if he wanted to be a bigger star. And that's what he did. He had people in that company, he had the fans convinced that he was out of his mind. He had them convinced that he was legitimately crazy and very unpredictable. And he was a loose cannon. You never knew what he was going to say. You never knew what he was going to do. You know, if only he didn't get in that Humvee wreck. Who knows how far he may have gotten. I mean, he had drug problems anyway, but we'll never know. But then there's his famous and very personal feud with Chris Benoit. Now, it started out of the Dungeon of Doom feud with the Horsemen and Sullivan's feud with Pillman. After Pillman left, Sullivan feuded with another Horseman, that being Benoit, and it led to one of my all-time favorite matches in WCW history. In fact, I had it on my list of the top 15 matches in WCW history. Sullivan against Benoit, Falls Count Anywhere, at the Great American Bash 1996. Now, there have been far crazier matches since then. Like, if you watch that match through 2024 eyes, you might look at it and go, what's the big deal, right? But it was pretty novel at the time to see that. When you see these two guys fighting through the crowd into the men's bathroom and fans are all around them, and you've got Dusty Rhodes on commentary freaking out when he spots a woman in the men's john. There's a lady in the men's bathroom. I can't even do it justice. Like, you have to go back and just hear it for yourself in his voice, in that accent. He famously booked his own divorce in that angle, you know, when woman sided with Benoit over Sullivan. And he was booking at the time, and he wanted them to really make it look real. So they would travel together, and they would room together. You'd see them out in public. They'd be holding hands. And, you know, when you do that, you would hope, you know, there are two adults who are at work. I mean, this is their job and this is what they're expected to do. But you spend enough time around somebody and look, you're just tempting fate. Sullivan had said that he and Nancy were already living apart most of the time in separate houses in Florida. I think one of them was in the Keys. The other one was in Daytona. So, like, they knew they were headed for a divorce anyway. But he claims he never suspected anything might happen, because Benoit had a pregnant wife at home at the time, and he was concerned, Benoit was, when the angle was pitched to him, that his wife might be upset. So, like, even Benoit had reservations about doing it, but she was pregnant, and Sullivan said that he never thought Benoit would leave his wife for Nancy, which is what he ended up doing. So that's where the whole he booked his own divorce thing comes from. You skip ahead a few years, at the beginning of 2000, there was a lot of political turmoil behind the scenes in WCW, and a lot of jockeying for power between Sullivan and Vince Russo over booking. Benoit and a bunch of other wrestlers, they refused to work for Sullivan. You know, Benoit, for obvious reasons, because there was a lot of heat there and tension there. Benoit thought Sullivan had undermined him and sabotaged his career when Sullivan had previously been in control of the booking. Benoit went on this horrible losing streak in pay-per-view matches one year. I think it might have been 98. And he blamed Sullivan for it. You know, rightly or wrongly, he held him responsible for that. And even though Sullivan is the one who made the call to put the WCW title on Benoit at the beginning of 2000, I guess to try to prove, hey, you know, I'm a fair guy, right? You can work with me. Benoit still left the company. And he took Eddie Guerrero, Dean Malenko, and Perry Saturn with him because they all banded together and they asked for their release. It was all one big revolt against Sullivan and his booking that ultimately led to the Radicals getting their releases and jumping ship to WWE. Now, Sullivan, you know, he got a lot of crap after the Benoit murder-suicide from fans, accusing him of killing them both or you know, oh, he was there, he had a role in it, you know, it's his, they tied it back to his satanic character and the feud with Benoit because Benoit stole his wife. It was all bullshit. He didn't have a damn thing to do with any of that, but people joked about it anyway. You know, some people are probably dull enough to actually believe it, but it was just conspiracy theory nonsense. He was with Nancy for over a decade of his life. You know, they got together in 85. I don't think they actually married until many years later. But I'm sure it ripped him up inside when he heard about what happened. I mean, how can you? Like, if you're Kevin Sullivan on some level, now I don't want to say feel responsible, like it's all his fault. But it was his idea to book Nancy to leave him for Chris on TV. You know, that angle is the reason that Chris and Nancy ended up falling in love and getting married in real life. If they don't get together, they're probably both still alive today, or at least Nancy is. You know, that's got to be a hard thing to think about when you see how it all ended. It's just a really messed up situation. I don't know if he's ever commented on that before or not, but again, not that he should feel like he's responsible for what happened, but just like if I were in his shoes and I was the one who booked that whole thing and that's how they ended up together and then we see what happened, you know, 10 years later, I don't know. It would just, I feel like it would be a mind fuck. It would be a difficult thing to try to process. But he was definitely an influential figure in the business. He had a major hand in the booking of WCW at times in the mid to late 90s. It's very likely that some of the aspects of WCW television that you liked and that led to their boom period, Kevin Sullivan had a hand in. I saw Tom, the person who runs the WCW Deep Cuts Twitter page, mention one idea that I had not known about from the 96-97 period. Sullivan hired about half a dozen big guys. Like Roadblock. Remember him? Remember Roadblock? He would hire these guys, and you would think, you know, why would you hire all these big guys when you have the Giant? Like, why make the Giant look less imposing by kind of surrounding him by all these other big men on the roster? Well, his idea was you would have your top babyfaces go through those guys and beat them with their finish, you know, whatever their signature move was. So you would think that they actually had a chance in there with a guy like the Giant. You know, it gives your babyface credibility. It's a lot more impressive for Goldberg, you know, to go in there and beat a guy like that than someone like Brad Armstrong. And that's not a slight on Brad Armstrong. He could work circles around Roadblock, but he wasn't the most physically imposing guy. You know, one of the most impressive things was the night that Goldberg beat Raven on Nitro to win the U.S. title. When the Flock runs in and he's throwing Flock out left and right, Sick Boy and Kidman. I think Horace Hogan was in there. But he lifts Reese up into the air. And Ron Reese was like 7'1", 7'2", legit. Like, he just picks him up like he's nothing and gives him a jackhammer. You know, he did that to Reese a few times. Roadblock, too. So when he finally got the Giant up and he held him there for like a few seconds, I had never seen anything like it in my life. When Goldberg picked the Giant up straight up into the air, you know, and the Giant is working with him, and the Giant back then was a lot more svelte than he would be in WWE, where he really let his weight get away from him. But he's still a big guy. I mean, you know, he's legitimately a giant. You know, he's 400 pounds, whatever he was. I had never seen anything like that in my life. But it's smart. You know, not everybody thinks like that. And there were bad ideas, too. There were bad Kevin Sullivan ideas, too, to be fair. But he gets more praise from other wrestlers for his acumen behind the camera than I think he does even in front of it. One of my favorite little stories, Kevin Nash tells it, was the night after WrestleMania 14 when Vince brought Mike Tyson in. And Nash sees Sullivan in Nitro the next night. And Sullivan tells him, "Feel that, Nash? Water got a little cold last night. Hit an iceberg called WrestleMania. Because he knew. You know, he knew the tide was about to turn in the other direction. You could just feel it. And that's exactly what happened. He was a huge Boston Red Sox fan. Now, the Red Sox paid tribute to him last night at Fenway Park during their game with the Astros. They had a message up on the scoreboard that read, "In memoriam of Kevin Sullivan, you will be missed. Love, Red Sox Nation." That's pretty damn cool. And I didn't get a chance to mention this on the last show because I was so hung up on SummerSlam stuff, so I'll mention this here. I watched Steve Mongo McMichael's induction last Saturday into the Pro Football Hall of Fame. They always have the ceremony in Canton, Ohio, which is where the Hall of Fame is located. And with any luck, one of these years we'll get a physical WWE Hall of Fame somewhere that people can visit. There are more Chicago Bears in the Hall of Fame than any other team. And Mongo, before he got into pro wrestling, was most famous for his time with the Bears and their Super Bowl win in 86. He appeared ringside for the main event at WrestleMania 11 when Lawrence Taylor wrestled Bam Bam Bigelow. Later that year, Eric Bischoff signed him to a WCW contract as a color commentator when Nitro first started. Remember, he had his little dog Pepe with him every week. The dog looked scared shitless. Eventually, he got into the ring. He ended up as one of the Four Horsemen. He even won a United States Championship. Probably had more defenses than Logan Paul did. Not only did they have their usual ceremony in Canton, but at the same time, they were broadcasting from his home in Illinois, where he was surrounded by his old teammates who were flown in on a private plane. And his family was there, his wife, Misty, his daughter, Macy. They were at his bedside to present him with his official Hall of Fame bust. And it was a really tough thing to watch. It was very emotional. For those who don't know, Mongo was diagnosed in 2021 with ALS, also known as Lou Gehrig's disease. Lou Gehrig is one of the greatest baseball players of all time. He was only 35 or 36 when he was diagnosed with the disease. He's probably the most famous person associated with it. I mean, Stephen Hawking, I guess, would be the other. But it's a horrible disease. Just the idea of being diagnosed with it scares the shit out of me, just thinking about it. Because there's no cure. And it affects all of the nerves in your body that control voluntary muscle movement. And as those nerves waste away and they slowly die, over time you can't walk, you can't talk, you can't swallow, you can't even breathe on your own. Your mind still works. So you're effectively trapped inside a body that no longer does. And yet, there was Mongo, still hanging in there because he wanted to live long enough to see himself be enshrined in the Hall of Fame. And he was bound and determined to make it to Canton for the ceremony. He couldn't physically be there, though, so they brought the Hall of Fame ceremony to him. And there has never been a Hall of Fame induction like it in any sport. I mean, none that I've ever seen. As sad as it is to see him in that condition, I'm really happy he got that moment. That was special. When NXT moves to the CW network October 1st, they will be hitting the road. Shawn Michaels announced this week that the debut episode will air live from the Allstate Arena in Chicago with CM Punk making an appearance. And the following week, they will be in St. Louis, Missouri with Randy Orton making a special appearance. PW Insider says there is talk of running more often on the road in bigger arenas to raise the prestige of the brand now that it's going to be on broadcast television. But as of right now, those are the only two road shows on the schedule. The remainder of their shows this year will still be held at the Performance Center in Orlando. Look, I'm sure if those first two shows sell well, and they will, I mean, I expect them to, we're going to get more road shows for sure, if not later this year, then to kick off 2025. CW is said to be all in on promoting NXT as much as possible, and there have been even some ideas floated already for NXT talents to appear on other CW programming as a kind of a way for them to cross promote. What was those shows on the CW? They had like Gilmore Girls or Glamour Girl. They had this lineup of shows that they, I think, used to have. I don't even know if any of these shows are a thing anymore. Yeah, let's get some of the WWE talent on Gilmore Girls. That'll be a good fit. All of this makes sense to me, though. WWE is a hot product right now, and they're going to want to make this move to the CW as big as they possibly can, as much of a success as they possibly can. 10 years ago, PC still had that new car smell, and NXT had only first started airing on the WWE network. Now it's a property that is said to be netting them anywhere from $30 to $35 million a year. They've come a long way. And they're actually producing new stars from there. You know, for so long, they were barely creating any new stars from scratch. Only the ones they plucked from the independent scene or they took from other promotions. And I guarantee you, CM Punk and Randy Orton, they are not going to be the only main roster talents making appearances on those shows. Now, this comes the same week that AEW announced another edition of Title Tuesday for October 8th, which is going to be the last stop before their Wrestle Dream pay-per-view. Likely because of playoff baseball, AEW is going to get bounced around a few times in October. But that show is going to be running directly opposite the NXT show from St. Louis. Now, the last time the two shows went head-to-head, WWE loaded it up with John Cena, The Undertaker, Cody Rhodes, LA Knight, Asuka was there, Rhea Ripley, Finn Balor, all at the Performance Center for NXT. They were not messing around. They did everything in their power to ruin Tony Khan's birthday, because it fell on his birthday. And based on his social media meltdown, they achieved their goal. WWE made the first 30 minutes of the show commercial free, and so Tony Khan got TBS to make the first 30 minutes of Dynamite commercial free. He even added a buy-in pre-show for Dynamite that night. It was a fucking dumpster fire on social media, especially after the ratings came in, and it's absolutely going to happen again this year, because wrestling fans just like to see the world burn, so get ready for it. Either that or just stay far away. You know, for all that star power they added, WWE, they still couldn't crack a million viewers for NXT, but they still trounced Dynamite. Dynamite did a little over 600,000 viewers. Almost a year later, here we are, and that's basically what AEW is averaging now on most Wednesday nights in their normal time slot. I shudder to think how they're going to do on an off night this time around. But my big takeaway from last year was that both shows were a lot of fun. You know, trying to watch them at the same time was not fun, but I enjoyed the shows. Hopefully we get that again this year. WWE, they've got plenty of potential aces up their sleeve for those shows. They got Julia coming in, we know that. Stephanie Vaquer is coming in, we know that. If they don't save their actual debuts for those shows, they could save their first match for one of those shows, or both of those shows. You know, or if Roxanne is going to lose her championship to either one of them, do it on one of those shows to make a big splash. Motor City Machine Guns, they could be on their way in. They'll probably get an NXT run first. You know, they could always debut them as a surprise. Ricky Starks, I don't know when his AEW deal is up, probably not before the end of this year, but imagine Ricky showing up as a surprise. We know he's coming in at some point. Or how about Penta and Rey Fénix? That's the latest as of this week that the Lucha Brothers are expected to be leaving AEW this fall to make their way to WWE. Brian Alvarez reported that the internal belief within AEW is that they would be leaving for WWE when their contracts expire. Wrestle Purists said the same thing, and that a trios championship match set for All In was to have included them and has since been changed. They have not been on AEW television of late. They currently have no match on the Wembley card. Fightful says that those close to the brothers claim that they have already engaged in talks with WWE, which is interesting. If they are still technically under contract, how they would be able to even have even informal talks with WWE, but apparently it's happening. Dave Meltzer says the belief is that Penta has really pushed for a main roster spot because there's no way they could turn down what they're making in AEW for NXT-level money. Just because he pushed for it doesn't mean he's going to get it, even though they're both more than ready for a main roster run. They do run a lot of, I can't say everybody, because there are some people who will skip over NXT. But the vast majority of the people they bring in, no matter how many years of experience they have, they do run them through NXT first to get acclimated, just, you know, to how they do television. They did the same thing with Dragon Lee. And by the way, what the hell ever happened to Dragon Lee? Where the hell's he been? He's pulled a disappearing act. But to add more fuel to the fire, Phoenix just pulled out of an independent date for September 27th due to what they claim were personal circumstances. Phoenix and Penta, they've already filed trademark applications for a whole bunch of different names and terms. Cero Miedo, Zero Miedo, Animo, or Animo, I guess you say. Fuego, King Fuego, Rey Fuego. Which might give us a hint at what their future names are going to be. I said when the news first broke a couple of months ago that Penta could become a free agent soon. Remember that news came out first. I said at the time I didn't know what his main priority was, if it was to still be able to work Mexico and still do independent shows, or if he was looking to get a run in WWE, you know, get in while the going's good and just make the most money he possibly could at a time when everybody knows WWE business is booming. I didn't know Phoenix's contract status. I didn't know his contract was also coming due soon, although that doesn't necessarily mean his deal is expiring at the same time as his brother. Plus, keep in mind, Phoenix missed considerable time due to injury. You know, Tony Khan could always tack that time onto his deal if he wanted to. But if they go to WWE, they're not going to have the freedom to book themselves anywhere that they want to. Although WWE under Nick Khan has been more open to talent working select shows outside of their bubble. Yeah, they've been doing that with Josh Barnett's Bloodsport shows. They sent AJ Styles to go work Mara Fuji at a Pro Wrestling Noah show. They let Io Sky work a Marigold show for Rossi Ogawa. You know, NXT has a working relationship with TNA. One of the biggest names on NXT television right now is a TNA star. And Penta is a former world champion in TNA. So times are changing. Even if they sign with WWE, that doesn't necessarily mean they won't get to work any outside shows at all. But they would, for the most part, have to be exclusive to WWE. Phoenix and Penta, they have been a part of that AEW roster from day one. Okay, going all the way back to the first Double or Nothing. They've held the AEW tag team titles and the trios titles with Pac. Phoenix, right, he's a former international champion. Phoenix has also been hurting of late, even after he came back from injury. He's beat up. He's also younger than Penta is, but he's probably got more miles on his body than Penta does. It's kind of just the nature of the style that he works. Eventually, it catches up to you. They may be looking at this as their last chance. You know, 5 years in one place is a long time. And Penta is going to be 40 years old next year. Phoenix is banged up. If ever there was a time for them to make the jump, it feels like this would be it. I can't blame Tony Khan for not doing much lately with Phoenix because he's been out hurt. But, you know, Penta, though, he should absolutely be doing more with him. And when he's on TV, he should not just be wrestling random matches. Like, give him something to do. Give him an actual story. The last singles match that he had was 2 months ago on Rampage against The Butcher. Like, what? What are we doing here? He's still over. He's still popular. Phoenix is out. You don't know when you're going to get him back. Give Penta something to do. He was in a qualifying match for the ladder match of Forbidden Door and he lost. He should have been involved in something. It could be as simple as that. You know, they just want to be doing more. Maybe Penta is unhappy. But if they leave, it's a big loss for AEW. Not because they've got, you know, they've got so much TV time invested in the Lucha Bros this year, but because they're a pair of AEW originals. And they're popular. The money that WWE can make just off of Penta merchandise alone and selling those gloves. You know, between that and their desire to expand into Mexico, you saw it with their tour last month right after they signed Stephanie Vaquer. She was the biggest female star in that entire country, and she didn't even have time to drop her titles before WWE had her on the show wrestling Isla Dawn. You don't think WWE isn't planning to do a major show in Mexico at some point, maybe even a PLE? They have good reason to want these names on their roster. It makes all the sense in the world for them. If I'm Tony Khan and I haven't already done so, I'm sitting down with both these guys and having a heart-to-heart to see what is it going to take to keep them. Because as originals go, they may not be Cody Rhodes, right? They may not be EVPs, but it would be a pretty damn big loss if they make that jump to the other side. One man who may be going the opposite way, leaving WWE and potentially ending up in AEW, is Bobby Lashley. Fightful is reporting that his contract is up as of this weekend. So if you are listening to this, Lashley should be a free man now. MVP's contract already expired, I think, last week. So wherever Lashley lands, there's a pretty good chance he's going to have MVP with him and maybe even Shelton Benjamin, too, for a Hurt Business reunion. Lashley was a guest on the Laboratory podcast. He spent an hour with these guys, and during the interview, he was asked about whether he preferred Vince McMahon or Paul Levesque as a boss. This is what he said. I had a connection with Vince. Vince understood me. Vince was big on the show. He looked at people that were stars, and he saw that in me. Yes, like when he had Lashley bending over on television for months and showing us his asshole. He really understood me. Said there were a lot of little nuggets that Vince would give me all the way throughout my career and tell me different things. So Vince just looked at me. He was like, I can tell Bobby works his ass off. I can send him anywhere around the country to represent the company and the brand. He just looked at me like a star. So I like Vince. I haven't really had too much of a connection with Hunter. Hunter has his guys, and I've tried to, but we haven't really worked enough together to get to know each other. He also confirmed that he did get hurt during his last match in France. I think it was the night before Backlash. He had a match with Santos Escobar. He said it was a freak accident. He had surgery. He didn't say what the injury was. He thought he was going to be out for 6 months, but he is ahead of schedule. He thinks he can be cleared in less than a month. At that point, he says, we'll see what happens. For all the dumb bending over stuff and the terrible, you know, Lashley sisters stuff, I mean, I try to block all that out. That whole period was just freaking awful. The Hurt Business was a thing under Vince. And Vince did put the WWE title on Bobby Lashley. Since taking over the book, Triple H really has not done much of anything with Lashley. You know, the stuff about Triple H having his boys. Swerve Strickland, it reminded me of that, because Swerve Strickland talked about something similar when he joined AEW, saying that he didn't have the greatest relationship with Triple H. And it's not that they didn't get along or they didn't like each other, but he just never felt like he was one of Triple H's boys. In the same way that he felt Finn Balor was, and Adam Cole, and Tommaso Ciampa, when they were all in NXT, and he would see them behind the scenes talking to Hunter and laughing and yucking it up. And he just never felt he had that same connection, or he wasn't viewed the same way by him. I think there is something to that. I think Triple H, as and you could probably say this about a lot of promoters, probably Vince too, Triple H has his guys that he likes, or that he sees something in them that he doesn't necessarily see in other people. Or he trusts them in a way that maybe he doesn't trust other people that he doesn't know as well, right? It doesn't mean that those other people are not going to get a push or a chance to succeed. You know, they're going to get buried. But he probably has his guys like Finn Balor and a Sami Zayn and a Kevin Owens and Tommaso Ciampa, Johnny Gargano, even a Nia Jax, right? He brought Nia Jax back and he's given her a push. She's the champion now, Queen of the Ring. These are people that he would know from his days running NXT. And so he either brought them in himself or he worked with them going back to the black and gold days. He's implying here that Triple H doesn't see him as a star in the same way that Vince McMahon did. Just based on the way he's booked him, I would say there's probably something to that. He's got a good reason to feel that way. But he also didn't say anything nearly as bad about Triple H as what MVP has been saying on Instagram. Lashley just never had that personal relationship with him the way that he did with Vince. You know, I guess Triple H doesn't have any toys at home named after Lashley, like Vince probably does. One of the many things from that lawsuit that I wish I could permanently bleach from my brain. So Lashley is going to try his hand somewhere else, right? It could be AEW. Could be another run in TNA. It's interesting how he says he tried to, whatever that means. Like he tried to forge a relationship with him. He tried to be one of his guys. But they just don't have that relationship. I'd be curious to know if any attempt was made to sit down with him and just kind of air all of this out. Or if Lashley is just pitching ideas that keep falling on deaf ears and he just got frustrated and he's like, fuck this, I'm out of here. He didn't really expand on that, so I'd be curious to know. I mentioned Vince McMahon. his attorneys had filed a motion to block Janelle Grant's attempt to obtain her medical records from Dr. Kolker at Peak Wellness. That's Vince's celebrity doctor that he also sent her to, allegedly. They had argued that with her agreeing to place her lawsuit on hold at the request of the Justice Department, that there should not have been any activity going on, I think, for a period of 6 months, and any activity related to the case should have been frozen, and therefore it shouldn't be allowed. They did not want this woman to get access to her own medical records, as ridiculous as that sounds. And the court agreed, and his motion has been denied as of this week. Brian Danielson, kind of looping him in here, Brian Danielson did an interview with the Gorilla Position podcast, and he was asked about Vince McMahon. He said, first and foremost, I want to say people that have been hurt are in a way worse position than I am. My empathy goes to them. There's not a lot I want to say about it, honestly, because it's not just the Vince piece, but my father-in-law, or maybe ex-father-in-law, as far as that kind of stuff goes. You think of somebody in some way, and then something happens and it changes. And that's always hard. But like I said, as hard as that may be for me emotionally, it's way worse for people who have been victimized by people in power. That line about Laurinaitis maybe being an ex-father-in-law would appear to be something new that has not been mentioned before, and is completely understandable given that he is being sued as part of a sex trafficking lawsuit. He should have been out on the lawn with all of his clothes the week that suit dropped. So I am not surprised in the least. We had SummerSlam fallout on Raw and SmackDown this week. If I had to describe Raw versus SmackDown as a match, Raw would have been Brock Lesnar and SmackDown would have been John Cena from their SummerSlam match 10 years ago. A total squash. Raw was the clear runaway show of the week. That felt more like the Raw after WrestleMania than the actual Raw after WrestleMania. They had a great show on Monday night. We had the Wyatt Six in-ring debut against American Made, which is the name of the new group with Chad Gable and the Creed brothers. Of course, they lost, because you got to give the Wyatt Six a win in their debut. You have to. Can't beat them in their first match. And I thought they looked good. I thought the presentation was very well done. They were well received by the audience. That was only their first match. We still haven't seen Nikki Cross in the ring. We haven't seen Uncle Howdy, Bo Dallas in the ring. I'm sure we're going to get a singles match with him and Chad Gable soon. So they're off to a good start. Randy Orton stepped up. As a surprise, he stepped up to challenge Gunther for the World Heavyweight Championship at the Bash in Berlin later this month. Now, if you remember, they had their match in the King of the Ring finals. And Orton's shoulders were up off the mat, clearly, when the referee counted three. Now, whether you believe it was a botch, whether you think it was planned that way and they were going to circle back around to it, I think it was a botch that they're turning into something that works story-wise. And I love shit like that. At the time, Triple H did say that after what happened there, there would be a rematch. I mean, Gunther was still going to be the King of the Ring no matter what. They weren't going to take his crown away or, put it on the line. But that we would have to have a round two between them. And then there was no mention of it after that. I thought maybe they were going to do the match at Clash at the Castle, and that didn't happen. But it's smart to have Orton as his first challenger, because it also gives them a big name opponent for Gunther for that Berlin show, right? That's a marquee match right there to do Orton and Gunther for the championship. And so because of that, it makes sense that Triple H would allow Orton, in storyline, to cross over to the other brand. Even though he's a SmackDown guy, he walked right into Raw on Monday, and he was there to shoot a shot. And it makes sense that he doesn't have to worry about, being part of an official trade between the two GMs, which I'd like to see. I'd like to see them do more of that. Now, if it's a one-shot deal, Orton can go back to SmackDown after this and still work with Cody Rhodes for the WWE title. Again, initially I thought the Gunther and Orton match would be a Clash at the Castle. He would lose, and that would be the catalyst for him to finally snap and just go heel, because he was tired of all the losing. As I've been pointing out, he has not won a single PLE match all year, has Randy Orton. He lost at the Rumble, he lost at the Chamber, he lost at WrestleMania, he lost at Backlash, he lost at the King of the Ring, he lost at Money in the Bank thanks to Cody, who took the pin from Solo Sikoa. didn't even have a match at SummerSlam. Now he's going to go into Berlin and lose again. And at some point, there has to be a reckoning here. Randy Orton is not just going to be, you know, doing jobs all year long and not come out of it on the other side in some way as a heel or doing something, you know, major, because that's just not how you book Randy Orton, right? Randy Orton is being primed for a heel run against Cody Rhodes and possibly beating Cody to win the WWE title. I've had people ask me, you know, if you do that match, let's say at Bad Blood, do you have Randy Orton win? Do you put the championship on him and actually beat Cody Rhodes? I say yes. I say if it plays out this way and you do that first match, Randy Orton should win the WWE title and Cody could win it back. Cody, of course, is going to win it back. I don't see any harm whatsoever in doing a title change. It freshens things up a little bit. Cody has to chase now to get the belt back. Not everybody has to go one full year and then some as the world champion. So absolutely, I would do a title change. But him and Gunther is not the match I was expecting in Berlin, but it makes all the sense in the world. So, I mean, I'm fine with it. The new Judgment Day looks a lot like the old Judgment Day, but they lost two of its biggest stars, Damian Priest and Rhea Ripley. They are now full-blown baby faces. Liv Morgan is now in the group with Dominic Mysterio. Finn Balor, I guess, is the, you know, he says the Judgment Day was never supposed to have leaders, but he kind of is the de facto leader now. He and JD McDonagh, they're the Raw Tag Team Champions. Carlito is still, you know, in the background there eating his apple. He's with them as well. There's a void in the group now for a big guy now that Damian Priest is gone. So I think that if it were up to me, I would consider adding a new member to the Judgment Day. You know, it's too bad they got rid of Dijak because he could have been a great addition to that group. I had somebody in the YouTube comments during the week throw Baron Corbin's name out there. And you know what? I'm not opposed to that. I'm not opposed to that as an idea. He's actually getting over now as a babyface. He's been so marginalized for so long after all the shitty gimmicks. Even something like that, I think, could work. I don't know if they want to add somebody to the group. I think the idea is that, you know, Balor is in no rush to give Priest what he wants. He wants him in the ring. And Balor says, well, too bad. You're going to have to go through the other members first. We had him wrestle JD McDonagh on Monday. I think the match on Monday night this week, I believe it's Damian Priest against Carlito. Eventually, he'll get his hands on Finn Balor. I don't know if they want to keep the Judgment Day going for another year or if they're just going to keep them going long enough for Damian Priest and Rhea Ripley to take them down. You know, by WrestleMania, that may be the end of the Judgment Day. So they may not be looking to add somebody new. If it were me, though, I would. What I liked also on Monday was the explanation that Balor gave for why he did what he did. Why did he betray his friend? Why did he betray Damian Priest at SummerSlam? He brought it all the way back to a year ago, 13 months ago, at Money in the Bank, when Balor challenged Seth Rollins for the World Heavyweight Championship, and Damian Priest was Senor Money in the Bank, and he was sitting at ringside for the match, and he got up at one point. He stood up while Balor was on the top rope after telling Balor he would not cash in on him. And that one little distraction cost Finn Balor the match. And he said that, what was it that you said to me in the car to console me when that match was over? He said, Priest told him, Finn, it's time to man up. So he said he waited. He waited an entire year to man up. That's playing the long game is what that is. That's long-term storytelling is what that is. And I love it when they can tie it back to those things 6 months ago, 12 months ago. So I like that explanation. And the reaction that they got, yeah, there was a segment later in the show. It was after the Priest match with McDonagh. And things broke down, and the Judgment Day attacked him. Rhea came out. She tried to get her hands on Liv, and she did briefly, but then Dominic saved her. So they ended up scurrying away, and we were left with Priest and Rhea in the ring together. And the reaction that they got from the crowd, I mean, they were super over, and people were going nuts for this. So the story has worked. The story is working. People want to see these two get their revenge. Now you got to make them wait for it. You don't want to give that away. Right, you got to play it out a little bit longer. So I thought what they did with the Judgment Day on Monday was great. And then there was the segment with CM Punk and Seth Rollins. Punk had come out. He was cutting a promo. Rollins interrupted. They were ready to throw down. Drew McIntyre popped up in the crowd. felt left out. And he still had Punk's bracelet on his wrist. Punk went to go after him. That left Rollins in the ring all by himself when we had a wild Bronson Reed attack Rollins from behind. And he laid this guy out, and he went up and gave him six tsunami splashes, one after the other, after the other. Each time he went back up to the top rope, the people got louder. They were cheering. Michael Cole on commentary was losing his mind, going crazy. He did a tremendous job, I thought, really selling this. This, you know, gave me Vader Monsoon vibes from 96, the night on Raw when Vader debuted. And he ended up, you know, beating up Gorilla Monsoon, who was the president at the time. Now, he didn't give him six Vader bombs. He only gave him one. But it was kind of giving off those vibes to me. It was just chaos all around. Rollins is laying on the mat, coughing up blood. And he had warned Adam Pearce in a segment earlier in the show. They tied this all together. He had tried to approach Adam Pearce, felt like he was getting the cold shoulder. He said, well, I guess if I want to make it to the top, I'm going to have to take matters into my own hands. Well, he did. Boy, did he ever. Here's a guy in Bronson Reed who has been directionless for months now. Again, not buried. People throw that word around a little too loosely. But just directionless. He has not had a solid program to really sink his teeth into. But what he has been doing is getting featured on the show, and he's been getting that tsunami splash over. Whenever he uses it, it gets a reaction. That's kind of the way it used to be. You'd debut a guy on the syndicated shows, he'd wrestle job matches for months at a time, getting over his moves, and then you would kind of transition that person into an actual program. Kind of reminds me of that in a way. This right here was the payoff to all that. In one night, he went from just another guy on the roster to an absolute beast, destroying one of the top stars on the entire brand. Adam Pearce went on Twitter a few days later. He said, our medical staff has informed me that Seth Rollins has, in fact, suffered several cracked ribs and internal bruising, and as such will be out of action for an unspecified period of time. Bronson Reed, the cause of this last Monday on Raw, has been fined a massive yet undisclosed amount of money, which he has appealed, and I do not expect that Mr. Reed will be happy when I deny that appeal. So then Bronson Reed responded to this on Twitter and said, worth it, stooge, to which Adam Pearce replied, run your mouth more, big boy, make it double. So he has doubled his undisclosed fine. The angle was apparently done to write Rollins off television for a while, not too long. He is medically cleared, but he's banged up. I read that, and that sounds to me like he came back too soon, if he's all banged up. This man has worked one match since WrestleMania. That was at Money in the Bank last month against Damian Priest. He hasn't worked any of the live events. So why is he so banged up that he needs time off again after he just came back, unless he came back too soon? So it sounds like Berlin is off the table. Bad blood, though, could be Seth Rollins against Bronson Reed. That deserves, whatever Rollins is back, that deserves to be a PLE match, not a Raw main event. This is more than a Raw main event. And what it also does is it creates some separation now, some necessary separation between Rollins and Punk, so that Punk can go finish out his program with Drew McIntyre. Then they can revisit the issue with Punk and Rollins, maybe a little bit closer to WrestleMania. This could still be a WrestleMania match. If it were me, I would do that. I would hold off on that, and I would build it up for WrestleMania. What we were supposed to get this year, you do it at 41 next year in Las Vegas. Odyssey Jones debuted on Raw Monday night. Some of you may be going, who? Odyssey Jones. He was drafted last year to Monday Night Raw and made zero appearances. He was drafted back to Raw and has since made zero appearances until Monday, when he stormed down to the ring in the middle of a match between the New Day and AOP and helped out the New Day against the Final Testament. And he looked great. He did a couple of power moves that got over instantly in front of that audience. If you don't know Odyssey Jones, you know what I know of him from NXT. He's very charismatic. He got hurt. He was out for a while. He kind of fell off the face of the earth. But I know that he is a charismatic guy who I think is not going to have any problems getting over in front of this audience on TV. In many ways, you know, he is like Big E in that way. Big E is a very weird guy, but he's a very charismatic guy, and so is Odyssey Jones, and they haven't officially said he's a new member of the New Day, only that Kofi befriended him when Kofi was at the PC recovering from his injury recently, and they became friends, and he knew that New Day needed help. They were outnumbered against the Final Testament, so he wanted to help out. The way that Xavier Woods sold it is he didn't know about any of this. He wasn't clued in. So you could tell there was something going on there that's going to lead to potentially a New Day split. Now, when this angle began, where Karrion Kross was trying to drive a wedge between these two, I didn't actually think they would have the balls to follow through on it. Now I'm not so sure that we aren't going to get at least a temporary split. At some point, Xavier Woods is going to go, you know what? Maybe you do see me as less than. Maybe you are holding me back. I need to go out and do this on my own. I need to get my own run. And we get a New Day split. And if you split the New Day, you could eventually have a New Day reunion. And that could be a big moment. But this is exactly the sort of thing they need to be doing to try to inject new life into this group and this angle, because it has just been flatter than a fucking pancake. So I like this. I am interested now in a way that I wasn't before to see where it goes. And it's about damn time, if they drafted him twice to this show, that we had Odyssey Jones actually show up to work and do something on TV. Now, over on SmackDown, Roman Reigns made his first appearance on the show since before WrestleMania. He came out at the end of the show. He took out Solo Sikoa, Tama Tonga, and Tonga Loa all by himself. 1-on-3. No problem for the Tribal Chief. Jacob Fatu was not there. He was not even at the venue. After selling a leg injury at SummerSlam that was off the top rope splash through Cody Rhodes through the announce desk. And then he was spotted in a walking boot after the show was over, which is better than being on crutches, but still very concerning. I can't tell you how I had so many people calling me a mark for thinking that he might actually be hurt. Oh, he's not hurt. You're just a mark. Don't buy into it. They're just keeping him apart from Roman Reigns for now. And then Mike Johnson reported that there is a growing belief among WWE talent backstage that Fatu is legitimately injured. Now, I hope not. I don't want that to be the case, but if that turns out to be true, a hearty fuck you to all the real marks out there who think they know everything when they really don't know shit. Now, even if he is hurt, it does work to their advantage to keep Jacob apart from Roman Reigns. I'm not even saying that's a bad idea. I initially, during SummerSlam, thought that he maybe is just doing a really good job at selling. It didn't make sense for him to be involved in the finish, so it keeps him outside the ring. Once I saw him in the walking boot, yes, of course, you could always work people by wearing a walking boot even though you're not hurt, but it just didn't make any sense to me. Like, that just seems unnecessary. So that's why I was like, all right, you know what? Maybe there is something to this. But again, everybody getting on their high horse here. Oh, no, of course he's not hurt. Of course he's not hurt. If it turns out that he's hurt, boy, are you going to look stupid. That's why sometimes it's better to keep your mouth shut and wait for some news to come out. But even if he is hurt, again, it still works out. As long as it's nothing serious, you keep Roman and Jacob apart so you can build to something much bigger between the two of them. I know Roman against Solo is the match they're building to, but the WrestleMania match that I want to see is Roman Reigns one-on-one with Jacob Fatu. I don't know if we're going to get it, but that's the match I want to see. By the way, Fightful says that Roman is debuting new theme music soon. It's already produced. It's ready to go. I don't know if it's a Def Rebel special or not, but Head of the Table was, and that turned out to be one of their big hits. And so whatever this new music is, it is not the remixed Head of the Table theme that he used at SummerSlam and he used on SmackDown on Friday. They said one source called the new song expansive and lengthy, to say the least. This guy's going to be coming out like one of the Avengers. It's going to come out to some kind of orchestral 8.5-minute theme song. I can't wait. See, I wasn't sold on Head of the Table the first time that I heard it. It took me a few times, and then I grew to love it, because it really is a great theme. It suits him very well. But I guess they see it as more of a heel theme. I don't really see the issue in him keeping it, but I guess they think now that he's a babyface, he needs something different. So whether they wait until he gets back in the ring for that first match, I don't know when they're going to debut it. I remember there was talk about him getting new music before WrestleMania, gosh, was it 37? And then he went to WrestleMania with his regular, I think, Shield theme. And then they debuted the Head of the Table on like a random SmackDown. So there's no telling when we might hear it, but maybe they'll wait until he has that first match back against Solo and then they'll debut it there. Cody Rhodes now has a challenger, as Gunther does, for Bash in Berlin. I wasn't even sure Cody would be defending the title on that show, but he's going to be defending the WWE Championship against Kevin Owens. This is not a match that Kevin Owens wanted, not because he's afraid of Cody, but because, as he explained on Friday, he feels he doesn't deserve it. He said, look at my win-loss record this year. He goes, I don't deserve it. Cody managed to manipulate him by going to Nick Aldis, and the two of them basically conspired against the Kevin Owens by having Nick Aldis claim that, oh, well, you know, it's a moot point anyway, because I was planning to go to Roman Reigns. And Kevin Owens did not like that very much because, of course, Roman Reigns made his life a living hell. And every time Kevin Owens got in the ring with him for the title, he got screwed out of a win by the Bloodline. So he went on this whole dissertation about how he doesn't deserve it. And if it's the automatic rematch thing, that hasn't been a thing for years. I never got my rematch for the Universal title. Just go to the locker room, open the door. You'll find any number of people who are deserving of getting a shot at the championship other than Roman Reigns, right? He's saying all these things and being very selfless. And then when he walked away, Cody told Nick Aldis, see, I told you it would work. So Aldis has made it official. We're going to get Cody and KO. Are we going to get a Kevin Owens heel turn? I don't know. I don't know that we need one, especially if we're going to get one from Randy anyway. But Owens is like a chameleon. I mean, it doesn't matter what role he plays. He's going to be great at it no matter what. He's been a great babyface. He's been a great heel, right? We know he can be a great heel. The thing is, though, they do need another top heel or two at the top of that SmackDown card. They really have a void right now. So turning Kevin Owens heel and turning Randy Orton heel would give them those two heels that they desperately need right now. So where there is a need, maybe it makes sense. LA Knight is the new United States champion. According to a new report from Fightful, LA Knight will be with WWE for many more years to come. They reported that during the summer, Knight both restructured and extended his existing WWE contract for both a large money increase and for significant time. His original deal was apparently set to expire in early 2025. Good for him, man. Get that bag. This is the spot that he's always wanted. This is the spot that he probably never thought he would get. There was a point that I'm sure in his mind, he thought this is just not going to happen. It was when he was Max Dupri. How could he imagine that he would have such a reversal of fortune? Things would work out the way they did. The old man would leave. Triple H would ascend to the throne. He'd get his name back. Right? It's been a long climb. He's been climbing this mountain now for a couple of years, but he finally made it. He's the U.S. champion. He's got a new contract. He's making more money than he's ever made before. Good. Good. This push has been a long time coming, and I'm glad to see them finally follow through on it. Tony Khan has broken his silence on his meeting at the airport with Shane McMahon. Shane already commented on this through Bully Ray on Busted Open Radio last week. Tony was asked about it during an appearance on ESPN Radio on Tuesday. He said, well, as I understand, he's not doing anything with WWE, and I had a really nice visit with him. I had heard from a lot of people that he was interested in talking, and it had become, frankly, a big media story to the point where I was getting asked on-the-record questions about it, and I answered them, and just like I'll answer you now. I had never met him in advance of my first conversation with him. There was a lot of buzz about this, so I thought it would certainly be worth talking, and I have a lot of respect for him. I had never met him, but he seemed like a really nice guy. I sat down with him, but he was fantastic. I really enjoy talking to him, and he is a very smart person about wrestling, and I thought he was a great guy, and we have a lot of mutual friends, and we both happen to be in Dallas. A mutual friend linked us up, who is one of the bigger names in pro wrestling. Was it the Learning Tree? Because I think it was the Learning Tree. And that friend put us on a group chat. We were both in the same town at the same time. Somebody in the middle of talking at an airport conference room, somebody just busted in, I guess, and took a photo, but I think that's fine. Yes, I guess someone just randomly busted into the room and took their photo. What is this? The royal family? Got paparazzi all around them? Like he didn't want this out there. But fair play. There's nothing wrong with having a conversation. Maybe they can tape trade since they're both big wrestling fans. Just keep them off my television, please. Tony also tweeted his thanks to Mr. David Zaslav for having him in Paris for the Olympics for what he called the trip of a lifetime. He also said later about their media rights deal, right now is the most important time ever in AEW. We are on the verge of the most important deal we will ever make. I think now, over 5 years, it's really been building to this point where AEW is going to jump into the media rights and be a very profitable, successful company. He also tweeted about the most important announcements, plural, in AEW history, quote, looming large. I tell you what, if this deal he makes with Warner Brothers Discovery doesn't knock people's socks off for all this talk about how great of a deal it's going to be, because that's all he's been saying, is this going to be a great deal, it's going to be a wonderful deal, best deal ever. If it's not, he's going to have people all over him. But he's got people all over him every week, no matter what he says, so I guess it really doesn't make that much of a difference. It's not going to be different than every other day. But it does feel like this is the home stretch, like this is finally reaching a boiling point. Maybe they want to wait and tie the announcement in with the Wembley show. I can't wait for him to announce something so I can stop talking about the announcement. Now, he's been negotiating with David Zaslav directly. David Zaslav is, of course, the head of Warner Brothers Discovery. He's on the hot seat right now, per CNBC. Says that Warner Brothers Discovery shares have plunged 70% in the last 2 years. Of course, you hear all these stories. He's been trying to cut costs. They're over $40 billion in debt still. He's been trying to cut costs left and right. Thousands of layoffs. They just lost the NBA rights. They filed suit against the league in court. Then their stock dropped 9% on Thursday alone, after the company took a whopping $9 billion write-down, given the loss of value in its linear cable network. So what that means is they concluded that their TV assets, so the TNTs and TBSs of the world, True TV, all these network assets that they own, are not worth nearly as much as they thought they did. And losing the NBA probably has a lot to do with that. Think of an upside-down mortgage where the money you still owe on your home loan is more than what the actual house is worth. Not good. But I think there's been a general acknowledgement that this was probably the case, especially as more people continue to leave TV behind for streaming. Again, their stock price, it's not like they just dropped this week. It's been going up and all of a sudden it went down. It's been dropping for the better part of 2 years. This is more than anything else, I feel like it's more of a black eye. For them and for him. But Zaslav is the one that Tony Khan is directly negotiating with on a new deal. If anything were to happen with him, what effect might that have on AEW? Right? It's unlikely, I think, that anything would happen with him before a deal gets made. So they should be okay. But like, these are very volatile times for Warner. And if I'm Tony Khan, I want this deal done yesterday so I know my future is secure. It's like when they signed their first deal right before COVID hit. You wait a couple of more months and the world turns to shit. AEW is in a very different place than it is right now. Are they even on TV? Is there even an AEW at this point? I mean, that's how big of a deal that was. As it turned out, wrestling was one of the only forms of entertainment that gave these networks first-run programming every single week during all the shutdown. So it proved to be very valuable, you know, as a television property. But they didn't know that. They wouldn't have known that in March of 2020. There's no way they signed that deal if they waited an extra month or two or 3 months. There's no way that Warner Brothers Discovery signs them to the deal that they did. So they got very lucky. All the more reason to get that announcement in these next few weeks, because if they hit a snag, and things get dragged out even longer, there are external factors at play here that are out of Tony Khan's control. So AEW needs that deal now. And they need to come back with a better show on Wednesday than the one they gave us this week, because Dynamite this week was largely a bore. Predictably, I got about half a dozen messages from the sickos, as Tony Khan calls them, telling me to stop covering AEW because you didn't like this week's show. I should stop watching the product because I didn't like this week's show. You know, it's funny. When I praise the shows, I don't hear a goddamn thing from these people. Only when I don't like the show or I say bad things about it that they disagree with, they pout like a girl that just got stood up at the prom. I know there were travel issues. All the key players made it who had to be there. MJF had to drive 10 and a half hours to get there for his match with Kyle Fletcher, which was very good. Bryan Danielson and Jeff Jarrett, they had a fun little brawl in the main event. But that show did not have me feeling that we were only 2 weeks away from what should be their biggest show of the year. They need to crank that energy up this week, because All In is coming up quick. At Wembley, Sunday, August 25th, 1 p.m. Eastern start time. This is the card as it currently stands. I'm going to wait a couple weeks before we get into predictions, because this card is not final yet. But they have 45,000 tickets out for the show so far. That's a little more than half of what they did last year. They should get close enough to 50,000 by showtime. They're going to end up with the second largest gate of all time for any promotion outside of WWE, second only to their $10 million gate for last year's Wembley show. I think people forget how massive that was. 4 years into the company's existence, to rake in over $10 million at the gate for one show, that is a huge milestone. Now, I was hoping that we would get the rematch here and expecting that we were going to get Chris Statlander and Willow Nightingale one-on-one, probably for the CMLL women's title. Statlander pinned Willow in an eliminator match a few weeks ago. But then last night on Collision, they shot an angle to announce a mixed tag on the pre-show with Willow teaming with Tomohiro Ishii against Chris Statlander and Stokely Hathaway. I'm assuming the match with Willow and Statlander for the title is being saved for All Out. Yeah, you got to remember, Tony Khan has another pay-per-view to book 2 weeks after this one. So if he's holding off on a couple of matches here and there, I can't fault him. I mean, I could fault him for running pay-per-views within 2 weeks of each other, which I think is fucking dumb. But he does have another show that he's got to book, and it can't all just be rematches from All In. So that has to be taken into consideration, too. I don't have an issue with them doing this. You know, they'll do the gimmick where Stokely, I'm sure, doesn't want to get in the ring and runs away. Stokely is very good in that gimmick. It looked like Kazuchika Okada would be defending his Continental title against Claudio Castagnoli. The two of them go face-to-face this Wednesday on Dynamite. But last night, Claudio challenged him to a match on Dynamite in Cardiff, Wales, 4 days before Wembley Stadium. And Okada has yet to accept, but he will. And maybe we get a rematch at Wembley that Sunday. Look, I don't mind it if they just keep it to Dynamite, honestly. I would rather this card not get too bloated. You can't be somebody, and I'm one of these people, you cannot be somebody who complains about the length of these AEW shows and how they're overly long and Tony Khan overloads it with too many matches. And then when some of the obvious matches are held off for TV or are held off for All Out 2 weeks later, complain that, oh my God, I can't believe they're not doing this on the Wembley card. Like, what do you want? Do you want a shorter card, or do you want the matches that you want to see regardless? Because all that's going to do is just drive up the number of matches on the show. And I'm perfectly content if they want to save this for Dynamite in Cardiff. It's going to be their first big international Dynamite. The crowd, I'm sure, is going to be crazy. It's going to be a great atmosphere. And they can headline. Instead of being in the middle of the card at Wembley, they could actually headline Dynamite with that match that night. So I think that's fine. And honestly, the match that I wanted to see at Wembley is not possible, which should have been Okada and Omega for the Continental Championship. That's the match I wanted to see on this show. Anyway, we're not getting it. So it is what it is. The Young Bucks. The Young Bucks have not been around all that much on TV. And some of you might like that. But it's odd because they are the tag team champions. They have not even defended their titles since winning them. You know when they won those titles? In April at Dynasty. unless one of them is hurt, and obviously they're not because they were in Blood and Guts a couple of weeks ago, there's no good excuse for that. I'm sorry. It's part of why the tag team division in this company feels flatter than my fucking tire the other day. The Acclaimed won an eliminator match weeks ago for a shot at the tag team titles. They're finally going to get that shot this Wednesday on Dynamite. Now, the Acclaimed have been spending most of their time beefing with FTR over on Collision. So what are the chances that this turns into a three-way match for the titles? I would wager pretty damn high. Making this a ladder match would make this more interesting. I would throw that in as a stipulation if it were me. Chris Jericho against Hook for the FTW title seems likely. It is not official. Like Statlander and Willow, it is possible they could hold off on the actual title match for All Out and do a trios match here instead if they can pull Samoa Joe away from filming Twisted Metal for one weekend, fly him to London, have him team with Hook and Shibata against Jericho, Big Bill, and Brian Keith. They shot an angle backstage off the air at the end of Dynamite on Wednesday where Hangman Adam Page and Jeff Jarrett got into it. It felt like the setup to a match. Could be for TV, but Hangman has no match on the card as of yet. He should not be wrestling Jeff Jarrett, though. What he should be doing is taking part in this next match, which we found out on Wednesday has been added to the card. They're doing another Casino Gauntlet match. This will be our third Casino Gauntlet match on AEW television here since, I guess, the end of April is when they did the first one for the international title shot. The last one was a lot of fun. It was actually one of their better TV main events of the year. And now we're getting a third one. And this time the winner gets a guaranteed AEW World Championship match. I think Hanger should be in this match and he should win the gauntlet. He's got a guaranteed shot then in his back pocket for a match with Swerve when he wants it, assuming that Swerve is still the champion. They're doing the Patriarchy defending the Trios titles against either the House of Black or the Bullet Club Gold Trio of Juice Robinson and the Guns, or both. Christian Cage refereed a number one contenders match on Collision between the two teams last night and screwed the House of Black out of a win when Buddy Matthews got to his feet at a nine count, then got speared by Christian, and then Christian counted both teams out. So we are likely headed for a triple threat. I'm guessing that this is where the Lucha Bros would have been involved. It would have been a four-way. Either it would have been a straight-up Trios title match for them, with Death Triangle going for the gold, or it would have been a four-way. Where that leaves Pac, I don't know. You know, he's already in line for an international title match. That is not happening on this show. Maybe it happens at All Out, but he has said that he wants his Wembley moment. So he has to be on this show. It's not going to be in this match. It could be in the Casino Gauntlet. I floated the possibility of him showing up, you know, doing an open challenge gimmick. Like, look, I told you, I want my Wembley moment. I'm coming to the ring. I'm going to be there no matter what. Anybody who wants to come out and challenge me, give it your best shot. And that could be maybe where Ricochet debuts. That was an idea I threw out there last week. But whatever they have him doing, he's got to be on this card. Britt Baker is going to be challenging Mercedes Moné for the AEW TBS title. We learned on Wednesday that Tony Khan has overturned the EVPs and has reinstated Britt Baker. So she will be back on TV this week. Although the way they handled that segment on Wednesday was head-scratching, because they had Tony Schiavone stand up on stage, interrupt Mercedes and Camille after Camille won her handicap match, and inform them that Britt Baker has been unsuspended, and everybody cheered because they thought Britt was there, and then Tony said, and now we have a message from Britt via satellite, and all the fans in the building booed, because they thought she was coming out, and she didn't. That was dumb. So they put a message up on the big screen from Britt, who said she's going to be back on TV this week. It's the it's Tony Khan overturning her storyline suspension because her real suspension is now over. And she could appear on the show again. Darby Allin and Jack Perry. Let me say one more thing about this. Again, I'm not getting into predictions yet, but that segment with Mercedes in the ring on Wednesday when she started cutting a promo had no heat whatsoever. No heat at all. Hopefully that will be different on the show this week, because I look at this card, of all the matches on the card that feel ice cold right now, this one feels the chilliest. And it shouldn't, because this is a battle between, you know, as female wrestlers go, Mercedes came into this company with a certain pedigree and a certain name recognition. Obviously, she was a big deal for a long time in WWE. She came here. She should be a big deal here as well. Britt Baker has been their alpha female since day one. It's the battle between the two biggest female names they have. This should feel like a bigger deal. Right now, it doesn't. They have 2 weeks to correct that. I like the idea of adding Camille. Obviously, I love that idea. And I think we know what it's leading to, but they've got to get something going here with the buildup, because at least on the end of Mercedes, I mean, Britt, some of Britt's promos have been good, but it was very noticeable on Wednesday when Mercedes was out there that people just, they were as quiet could be. Darby Allin against Jack Perry for the TNT title. Darby still has a Grand Slam match coming up at the end of September where he's wrestling for the World Championship. So now he's going to get the TNT title match first. Mariah May and Timeless Toni Storm for the AEW Women's World Championship. Will Ospreay challenging MJF for the American Championship. If Ospreay wins, he says he's going to return the belt to the international title. And Bryan Danielson, one-on-one with Swerve Strickland in the main event for the AEW World title. Bryan told Jim Ross that he thinks it's inevitable that he is going to need to undergo neck surgery before this year is over. Now, I think he's working everybody for the all-in build. They've been playing up his neck, going back to the Tiger Driver spot with Ospreay at Dynasty. Makes him more of an underdog, wrestling a fully healthy Swerve. That's the card so far. We still have two more Dynamites to go before all-in. That's 7 matches official at the moment, and at least 3 others teased, if not 4. We really do not need more than that. Not when they have another pay-per-view 2 weeks later. Now, I know better, because Tony's going to try to get everybody on this card. But I really think they're in a good spot where they are. Please. 10 matches? That's fine. We really don't need more than that. We definitely don't need another stadium stampede. I like the card as it currently appears. I like the card. Last year's show looked stronger on paper. They had more big names on that show. But I like this card too. The build to the key matches, I think, has largely been very good, especially Tony and Mariah, mainly Tony and Mariah. I have not looked forward to a women's match this much in a long time. It's a hell of a lot better than what they've been doing with Mercedes and Britt Baker. So long as we get a Jamie Hayter return at Wembley, though, then it's all worth it. One last news item here, this regarding the former president of TNA Wrestling, Scott D'Amore. Scott D'Amore has spoken out for the first time. He was on Busted Open Radio this week, and he revealed that he knew about his departure from TNA 2 days before their Hard to Kill pay-per-view back in January. That was their first show after rebranding to TNA again. And then it was on February 7th that Anthem officially announced that Anthony Chacon would be replacing D'Amore as the president of the company. He said, "Here's your scoop for your headline. I found out about that happening with me 2 days before Hard to Kill. I was about to get on a plane," which, by the way, if I'm remembering correctly, I think it was either at Hard to Kill or maybe it was at one of the Impact tapings where they had the Josh Alexander Will Ospreay match. I think that was it. And remember when he got into the ring, D'Amore did, and he cut that just impassioned promo, like he was screaming and just so emotional talking about what it meant, you know, TNA meant to him and putting over both guys. Looking back at it, that was a guy who knew that he was on his way out. And it kind of makes more sense now why he got into the ring and did that. He said, "I was about to get on a plane. I found out kind of what was in the cards. Anthem CEO Len Asper and I had a chat about it. Even though I had seen some signs, it still hit me pretty hard. But I did what professionals do. I locked that in a place in my brain and kept it there and flew to Las Vegas with Tommy Dreamer and the rest of the team. I hate when people give me all the credit and I hate when people give me all the blame. TNA succeeded because of the team we were able to assemble. I'm proud to have had the chance to lead that team, and I'm proud to have assembled that team." Now, he also said that the company sent him home. He is basically being paid right now to do nothing, which he admitted is kind of nice. And he dismissed rumors that the falling out was over him attempting to buy the company. Said, I dutifully finished out the Florida tapings and I left the building that night thinking that's it. Okay, I fulfilled my obligations. I woke up the next morning and did two things. I put Jordan Grace in the Royal Rumble and I started looking about where I could raise funds to acquire TNA. Any of the BS that I tried to buy the company and that's what led to me leaving was not the case. It boiled down to a difference of opinions on how things should be. There was no F you, no F you. I've spoken with Len Asper since then, like, as I said to him the day we talked about it, or it might have been the day that the announcement went ahead, he said, I hope there are no hard feelings. I said, I can't say there are no hard feelings, but there are no personal feelings. It was very conflicting. I was very proud of what we had done as a group and what we accomplished and where we came, and I was very upset that the reins got taken away from me at a time that I think we were perched and ready to continue to explode. Now, he also announced this week that he was reviving Maple Leaf Pro Wrestling. He obtained the rights to the promotion. That promotion goes all the way back to the 30s. And the Tunney family, Frank Tunney, Jack Tunney, yes, that Jack Tunney. He only went to the WWF after he had wrapped up with Maple Leaf Pro. So he obtained the rights to the promotion and the name. He announced that he is reviving it, starting with two events on October 19th and October 20th that will air as pay-per-views on Triller TV. And footage from the promotions library, I guess one of the few the WWE does not own, will be uploaded to YouTube, Facebook, and other digital platforms as part of the revival, which is very cool. So that's what he's going to be keeping busy doing. I still would say that when he is free and clear to do so, Tony Khan would be crazy. You know, he loves having conversations with people who love pro wrestling, right? Like Shane McMahon, he would be crazy not to have a conversation with Scott D'Amore to see what value he might be able to bring. And that would be specifically from a creative end, because unlike Shane, we know that Scott D'Amore has experience in that department. And I think he is somebody who could bring value. I think he is somebody who has proven himself and is somebody who also was well-liked by a lot of different talents and could potentially be brought in to, if not help on the creative end with AEW, could maybe be, you know, very beneficial to the Ring of Honor brand. I don't know how that would impact Maple Leaf Pro. He might want to just focus his efforts on that, but more so than Shane, I look at somebody like him and I say, hey, you know what? Bring him and give him the reins of Ring of Honor. Let him run that brand and build it into whatever he can build it into. And then, if that works out, see what added value he can bring creatively to the AEW end. I think he could be a great asset for Tony Khan. But I guess for the time being, he's not allowed to have those conversations yet. That might not be until next, I guess it would be February. I think that was the belief, is that January or February of next year, whatever his obligations are, non-compete, whatever you want to call it, would no longer be an issue, and then he can basically do whatever he wants. So it's going to be a very interesting early part of 2025. Now, with that out of the way, I did tell you, we got a lot of mailbag questions to get through, and we're going to get through them right now, but what I want you to do is make sure that if you have a question for me, you email me, thesolemonster@gmail.com. And always include your name and where you are from when you write in. Now we're going to kick off here with Brandon from Long Island. It says, I was watching TNT, smart man, and saw you mention if WWE could just wait for the first meeting between Damian Priest and Finn Balor until WrestleMania. Well, here's how I would get there if that were to happen. You do Priest against Balor 1 at Bad Blood and Balor wins. Priest against Balor 2 on Raw 1 month later, where Priest wins but is injured in storyline by the Judgment Day and is taken off television for a couple of months. Priest then returns as a surprise entrant in the Royal Rumble. He eliminates Balor, and we get Balor Priest 3 at WrestleMania 41, where Damian Priest wins. I think you've laid out a very smart, very cogent plan there. I don't really have an issue with that. I certainly think that's one way they could go with it. I think it makes a lot of sense. Pepe from Puerto Rico. I recently found out that William Regal contracted a parasite during a tour in India. Could you elaborate more on this? I cannot find enough information about what happened apart from some reports without many details. Oh my God. That was the tour from hell is what that was. WWE went to India. This was in 2002. And a bunch, it wasn't just Regal, a bunch of wrestlers got very, very sick. Regal was one of them. Lance Storm was another. Booker T got so sick, some of them almost died. And it was 15 years before WWE would return to India. They did not go back to that country until 2017. That's how bad it was. Not only because of the people that got sick, but I guess they didn't make enough money the last time they went. Because, you know, you just got to follow the money. If WWE had gone to India and they did gangbuster business, it wouldn't have taken them 15 years to go back. I remember Lance Storm saying that tour drew so poorly what he made for the entire tour, you know, however many shows that would have been, was less than most of his single day payoffs for working one house show in this country. They were horrified by the conditions there also. I remember that being a story at the time when they landed, and they were put up at the nice hotel. They were talking about some of the conditions and the things they saw in the streets, you know, people pulling their pants down and going to the bathroom and stuff. Like, I remember reading about all that. Booker got sick on the flight home and was so dehydrated they had to rush him to the hospital. With Regal, what happened was that he contracted a heart parasite that he didn't know about until a few months later. He was defending the tag team titles with Lance Storm in No Way Out. He wasn't feeling well leading up to the match. Then during the match, he got knocked out and he suffered a concussion. So he wasn't getting any better. He was only getting worse. He went to the doctor and they told him about the parasite. And they I think they diagnosed him with congestive heart failure. And they told him that he would never wrestle again. So obviously he did wrestle again, but he missed over a year before he was cleared to come back. So it was a very scary experience. And in the spirit of the Olympics, as they wind down, instead of the usual buy or sell questions, I've been handing out gold, silver, and bronze medals. I received an onslaught of them from you guys in advance of tonight's closing ceremonies. So this is it. And I'm going to answer as many of them as I can that I have not already answered privately by email. And there are a lot of them, so let's do this. Josh from Newcastle, England. I've recently started rewatching all of the WWF pay-per-views from 1995, as that year has always been a guilty pleasure of mine. I know you love the WWF product from that year. Yeah. So with that being said, gold, silver, and bronze on your favorite Bret Hart match from said year. Bret Hart against Hakushi from In Your House 1. Bret Hart against Diesel from Survivor Series. And Bret Hart against the British Bulldog from In Your House 5. That was In Your House Season's Beatings. I am going to give the gold to Bret and the Bulldog. As a match, it is better than their SummerSlam match at Wembley Stadium. That one, of course, is the more memorable of the two for all the obvious reasons. Pay-per-view main event, 80,000 people overseas, main event, Intercontinental title on the line, the family drama that they really built up, right? I mean, it's a much more massive match, but as a match, this was actually the better one of the two. Bret Hart against Diesel. I'm going to award the silver to that match. This was the second best match that Kevin Nash has ever had. Second only to the match he had with Shawn Michaels the following year in Omaha, right before he left the company. That was his last pay-per-view match before going to WCW. I still say that was the best match of his career. This was number two. And this was really memorable for two things. Number one, the table spot. It might have been the first time we ever had a table spot in WWE. You know, where Bret got knocked off the apron and went through a table. And then the post-match angle, when Diesel turned heel, or at least the tweener, and powerbombed Bret. And I always loved that powerbomb that he gave him, too. Like that first one, he lifted him up so high. Like, he dropped Bret in kind of a weird way because he almost kind of lifted him up with too much force. And Bret was all cockeyed, and then he got dropped to the mat. But I always thought that just was a devastating powerbomb. And it really got over. It was a great angle to close out that show. Had we gotten that Diesel for most of 95, maybe he would have gotten over more. But I give that the silver, and I give the bronze to Brett and Hakushi, because it was a very good match, but nothing special about it compared to these other two. Nir from Israel, gold, silver, bronze, or leave off the podium. These wrestler careers, Bret Hart, Undertaker, Sting, and Kurt Angle. Now, I gave this some thought. If we are talking overall careers, okay, so their influence, their longevity, their success, their matches, like all of it, start to finish, I'm probably going to give the gold to The Undertaker. I think his longevity, even with the breaks in between for all the injuries, I think that puts him just over the top. I could go Bret, of course, but I'm going to give the gold to Undertaker, and I'm going to give the silver to Bret. I'm going to give the bronze to Sting. And I hate to say it, but I'm leaving Kurt Angle off the Olympic podium. As a performer, Kurt is one of the greatest of all time. You cannot objectively say otherwise. I'm sorry. Kurt Angle is absolutely one of the GOATs. Bell to bell in the ring as a performer, he could do it all. He was phenomenal. I just don't think the longevity and the overall influence is there for him like it is for those other three. You're going to find a lot more people who will point to a Bret Hart, even wrestlers in the business now, who say, man, he was my influence. He's what got me to want to be a wrestler in the first place. Or I became a wrestler and I wanted to emulate Bret because his style was so believable. He was so great. Undertaker, same thing. You might hear people saying that he was my guy and, you know, he's what got me to want to be a wrestler and get into the business. And Sting is the same thing, because Sting's been around forever. I just don't think you hear that as much when it comes to Kurt. Joshua from Rochester, New York. Gold, silver, or bronze in the spirit of the Olympics? Which country will WWE bring their next international PLE to for the first time? China, Brazil, or Italy? Italy. There's already talk about it. I don't know how solid it is, but there's already talk about Italy possibly getting a PLE in 2025. So I'm going to give the gold to Italy. I think that they're... Oh, this is tough, because everyone's been trying to break into China for years now. But do I actually see it happening before Brazil? You know what? I'm going to give the silver to Brazil, just because I think there's probably more of a chance of it being Brazil than China at this point, and then give China the bronze. Matt from St. John's, Newfoundland, Canada. Gold, silver, and bronze on the Ric Flair, Ricky Steamboat matches from their 1989 trilogy, Chi-Town Rumble, Clash of the Champions 6, and Wrestle War 89. You can't go wrong with any of those three, and the scary part is none of those three might have been their best match that year. There's a house show match floating around, I think from March of 89. That they had that might have been their best match. I know it's online. You could probably find it online. It's got no commentary and the quality's not great, but that might have been the best of all the matches they had that year. I love all three. I would give the gold to their 2 out of 3 falls match at Clash of the Champions, and then I would go Chi-Town Rumble for the silver. That was their first match of the series. And then the bronze to Wrestle War, which was the final one. Although the post-match angle with Flair and Terry Funk was worthy of the gold all by itself. The other thing I loved about that match, the Wrestle War one, if you notice, it had the same finish that Steamboat used in his match with Randy Savage at WrestleMania 3. Steamboat won with the finish there, Mania, but he lost with it in this match with Flair, where he went for the slam, the body slam, but Flair rolled through into the pin. And I mean, it annoyed me that he just laid there. He gave no effort to actually kick out. That was dumb. But I always liked that little callback. I mean, whether it was intended to be a callback or not, that's how I always took it. So I like that aspect of it. Dylan from Toronto, Ontario, Canada. How would you rank these Bobby the Brain Heenan pairings in the gold, silver, and bronze medal format? And who gets left off the podium? Also, recently I was speaking with a coworker, and he mentioned he was also a sound-off guy. So shout out to Shamir. Hell yeah. Shout out to Shamir if he's listening right now, which I know he is. I love hearing that. So Bobby Heenan pairings, the ones he has here are Andre the Giant, Mr. Perfect, Ravishing Rick Rude and Ric Flair. I'll tell you right now, I'm going to leave Ric Flair off the podium altogether. I don't look at Heenan and Flair as being an official pairing in the way that he was with all the other names you just mentioned. He was supposed to be. And then as Bobby tells the story, because he helped introduce Rick into the company with all those vignettes, and he is holding up the big gold belt, teasing his arrival, and then he finally showed up. And I want to say maybe Heenan was actually like on the road with him in his corner for like a month or two, and that's all he could take. He just could not keep up with Flair, and he just said, I can't do this. And he retired at that point from managing and went full-time into the announcing. So I think that had they had more time together, it could have been the gold, but they just didn't. So I can't rank them, you know, against these other three. So I'm going to leave that off. I got to give the gold to the Andre and Bobby pairing because it's legendary. Yeah, it's just a legendary pairing. Mr. Perfect and Heenan gets the silver. I always loved it when Perfect was going down the aisle and he'd take that towel and toss it behind him, and without even like looking at the towel, Bobby would just grab it on the way down. They were always in sync together like that. And then Ravishing Rick Rude and Bobby, I'll give them the bronze. It's always weird when I hear Bobby in interviews in the past talk about how Rude, I don't know if they didn't get along or Rude just didn't like him and resented him because he felt like Bobby was stealing his heat. And Bobby would say, like, that's not what I was doing. I was actually doing the opposite. I was, you know, my job there was to enhance the heat. But I guess Rude maybe felt that Bobby was stealing his thunder, and, you know, I guess they didn't get along all that great. They were a great pairing, though. I can't rank that one above Andre or Perfect. Chris from Brandon, Manitoba, Canada. Gold, silver, and bronze. Which of these classic WWF icons would you bring back to enhance the show in present times if they could be in their prime? Howard Finkel as a ring announcer. Bobby Heenan as a manager, Gorilla Monsoon and Jesse Ventura on commentary. Well, if we could bring back all four, we'd have the perfect promotion. Look, I think the present day commentary situation in WWE is vastly improved from where it was a few years ago. But I am giving the gold medal to Gorilla Monsoon and Jesse Ventura on commentary. They are the voices that we would hear the most if they were on commentary. Okay, we have commentary for everything on these shows. So if they were on commentary, we would be hearing from them the most. Bobby would have his angles. The Fink, we would hear his voice with every match, but the announcers are the voices in our ears the most. They're the soundtrack of these shows. They can enhance the show in a big way, or they can detract from the show in a major way. Gorilla and Jesse is probably my third favorite all-time announcer pairing behind Gorilla and Bobby and Jim Ross and Jerry Lawler. And I always love Vince and Jesse. Vince McMahon and Jesse Ventura on Saturday night's main event, they were great as well. Maybe I'd go back and forth for third place with Vince and Jesse or Gorilla and Jesse, but they're up there. They're up there on my list. If they were back in their prime years, I got to give them the gold. I would love to have their commentary on these shows. I'm going to give Bobby Heenan the silver because anything they would give him would be gold anyway. Bobby is the greatest manager of all time, but he was so much more than that. He was a personality unlike any other, and he would absolutely enhance whatever show he was on instantly and considerably so. And Howard Finkel gets the bronze. You could argue the gold for any of the three, really, but I mean, Fink just had that voice, especially when it came to main event introductions. And I love Samantha Irvin. I think she does a great job. A little too performative sometimes, but I don't understand the hate that the woman gets in some circles. But no one can hold a candle to Howard Finkel. He is the GOAT of ring announcers. If I was a wrestler and I was winning the world title, Fink is the one who I would want with a microphone in his hand when he announces me as the new champion. Kennedy from Orlando, Florida. Gold, silver, and bronze for these underrated Monday Night Raw matches. Shawn Michaels against Shelton Benjamin from the Gold Rush Tournament. Bret Hart against the 1-2-3 Kid for the WWF title. And Marty Jannetty against Doink the Clown, 2 out of 3 falls. Kennedy, I don't think you understand the meaning of the word underrated. On what planet are those first two matches underrated? Most people rate them very high. I think you mean overlooked. Because they were on TV, they were not on pay-per-view. I'm assuming that's what you mean. I'm giving the gold to Bret Hart and Sean Waltman. I love that match. I'm going to award the silver to Shawn Michaels and Shelton Benjamin, one of the greatest match finishes of all time. And I'm going to award the bronze to Jannetty and Doink. But just because I'm giving that match the bronze does not mean that it's a bad match. It's actually a really good match. I did a rewatch on that a few years ago when I was going through the 1993 episodes of Raw. Really good match. Matt Bourne, great wrestler. So, you know, when given the chance, he could go. And Evil Doink was the best Doink. It's just too bad he couldn't get out of his own way and get his shit together. Chris from Cape Cod, the Cape Cod Crusader, with a gold, silver, and bronze question. Regarding the most evil heel runs, these are the shorter runs of absolute carnage, and I would like to know which one you think is tops. Earthquake, 1991. He killed Damien and crippled and retired Andre the Giant within weeks of each other. He also scarred Jake the Snake so badly that it led to number two, which is Jake Roberts, 1991-92. Ruined Macho Man and Elizabeth's wedding reception, attacked Macho with the Cobra, and slapped Elizabeth. And the Big Boss Man, 1999. Kidnapped, killed, and fed Al Snow his dog Pepper, ruined the funeral, and stole the casket of Big Show's father. You know, look, I love the Jake Roberts run from 91. I love it. I love it. I love that whole angle, him and Savage. It was so brief, but it was great. How can I give the gold to anything other than the Big Boss Man? What an absolute asshole he was in 1999. And it kind of came out of nowhere, too, because, you know, he came back to the company at the end of 98. And he was basically Vince McMahon's attack dog in the corporation, but he wasn't doing much. And then the latter part of the year in 99, it's just like they just went so over the top with all of the things that he did. So like you mentioned, Al Snow's dog, he kidnapped this man's dog, for those who don't know. And the story was, because they did different segments, and one segment was they were in a hotel room and there was a table all set up. And I guess Boss Man was going to treat him to this meal. It was all going to be water under the bridge. And Al sits down and starts eating, and what he didn't realize is that he was eating his own dog. Then, of course, he starts vomiting up the steak. Big Show's father, you know, in storyline, passes away. That poem, I mean, he read that poem on TV. How can I give the gold to anyone else when they go out on TV with a poem for this other guy whose father just passed away? And he reads the poem, "With the deepest regrets and tears that are soaked, I'm sorry to hear that your dad finally croaked. He lived a full life on his own terms. Soon he'll be buried and eaten by worms. But if I could have a son as stupid as you, I'd have wished for cancer so I would die too. So be brave, be strong, get your life back on track, because the old bastard's dead and he ain't never coming back." Tell me that he does not deserve the gold for that alone. You want to talk about short, abbreviated, evil heel runs. I just don't know that you could go with anyone other than the Big Boss Man. And then that's to say nothing, of course, of what you mentioned, which is him interrupting the Big Show's father's funeral in like the old Blues Brothers car with a fucking blow phone or a megaphone, whatever. What I call it, a blow phone? Where did that come from? I don't know what that is. It sounds like something that like an escort has on her at all times when she gets a call from a client. But I mean, and then the sight of Big Show chasing after the casket as it is chained to the back of the car and being dragged away and jumping on top of it. And then he takes this huge bump when he slides off. And the absurdity of it is that Bruce Pritchard has talked about it because Vince called him and said, "Look, I need you to produce something for me." And he had to get up and go out to an actual cemetery I imagine it was out in Connecticut somewhere, and they had to film this. And there were other ceremonies going on at the same time, and they were told in advance, please, you know, whatever you're going to do, just be quiet and be respectful. And, of course, they were anything but. It's like the story of the Katie Vick stuff, right? They filmed all that in an actual funeral home, and there was a service going on next door. Like, you kidding me? But my God, the boss man in 99 gets the gold. It's not even close. Jake, I got to give the silver because Jake was a fantastic heel during that period, brief as it may have been. And then Earthquake. Hey, I love Quake Burgers, but I got to give Earthquake the bronze. He can't compete with this level of just assholiness that we have from these other two. It cannot be topped. Julius from the Bronx, gold and silver medals, award them both for Shawn Michaels against John Cena, 55-minute match on Raw in the UK, and MJF against Will Ospreay on AEW Dynamite. I am giving the gold to MJF and Will Ospreay for their Dynamite match. Michaels and Cena are going to have to settle for the silver. That ought to get some people riled up. That's how I feel. It was the better match. And the more exciting match to me. And we got Dak from St. Paul, Minnesota. Gold, silver, bronze, and leave off the podium. The WCW Big Gold World Heavyweight title. The NWA World's Heavyweight title, 10 pounds of gold. WWF Winged Eagle title. And the IWGP Heavyweight title, the belt that was held by Okada, AJ Styles, and Tanahashi, among others. Yeah, I think that's considered version 4, I think, of the IWGP title. It's a great title. But to show you the quality of what we're talking about here, I'm only going to give that the bronze. I'm going to give the gold. I mean, do you even need to ask? Is this even a question? The Winged Eagle gets the gold medal, of course. I give the silver to the WCW World Heavyweight title, Big Gold. I thought the one that always looked the best was the one that Flair had back in like 86, 87. I'm talking like early Big Gold. Like, that's the shit right there. The bronze, like I said, I'm going to give to the IWGP title, which never should have been changed. And I'm going to leave the 10 pounds of gold. I know it's steeped in history, but I don't think it can compare to these other belts. I'm going to leave it off the platform. I'm sorry. And finally here, Dolphin VTuber from Australia. Gold, silver, and bronze for Corporate Rock, Hollywood Rock, and Final Boss Rock. All great versions of The Rock. I am going to give the gold to Hollywood Rock. I am going to award the silver to... Man, I really love Corporate Rock, though. Corporate Heel Rock. From The Rock and Austin days, man. I'm going to give the gold to Hollywood, I'm going to give the silver to Corporate Rock, and I'm going to give the bronze to Final Boss Rock. That is how I am going to rank them. So, thank you for all of the questions. Well, you guys really took advantage of that gimmick, didn't you? And I tried to email a few people privately by email. I may not have gotten to everybody. I still might try, but there were so many questions. There were so many questions, and I love it. Keep emailing me, even now that the Olympics are over, thesolemonster@gmail.com. Don't forget, I will be live, as I am every week, on YouTube Monday, Wednesday, and Friday on the Solid Monster Sounds Off channel after Raw, Dynamite, and SmackDown, respectively. And live on Tuesday night, 8:30 p.m. Eastern Time, over on JD from New York's channel for Tuesday Night Titans. We are 60 episodes in. Although I wasn't there for all 60, but I've been there now. It's been a few months. It's been 3 months. And I think this was our best show yet last week. Also our longest. We got to trim that a little bit. But look, when you get two people who love to hear the sound of their own voice, I mean, that's what happens. So, but I think it was our best show yet. The support has been great, and I hope you'll tune in for TNT on Tuesday. It's been a lot of fun. And next Sunday, of course, I will be here with you again for episode 875. Of the Solid Monster Sounds Off. We're getting awfully close to 900. And 900 is pretty close to 1,000. I can remember reviewing Raw 1000 back in 2012. Now we're not that far off from Sound Off 1000. It's going to be a while before we get there, but I can see it. Like a light at the end of the tunnel, you know, like you're still deep in the tunnel, but you see a little bit of light there. I can see it. It's coming. I'll see you guys next Sunday for more Sound Off. Be well, stay safe. Until then, the hell is a blowphone?
The Sala Monster Sounds Off.
We all need to have a moment of silence because Seamus' music, his original theme that was given back to him, has been stripped away from him once more. No warning, no reason given. It's like someone who loses a dog or a cat. The pet runs away, you're heartbroken. Oh my God, where did my cat go? You staple signs to all the trees in the neighborhood. You tape all the signs to the light posts and the mailboxes. Where, oh where, is Felix the cat? And then, years later, one day, out of nowhere, Felix reappears. Felix comes home and joy fills your heart. Tears are running down your face. You can't believe it. You've got your best friend back for 3 weeks. And then Felix disappears again. Now your heart is shattered into a million pieces all over again. And for what? Why? Where is Felix? That's what they've done to us. What makes it even worse, it'd be one thing if they replaced it with music that was actually better. They replaced it with more generic fucking crap. Or as I like to call it, the Def Rebel special. So keep Felix in your thoughts.
The Sala Monster Sounds Off. Each week, bursting with content. Podcasts, predictions, reviews, YouTube live streams, and more. Become a channel member for perks and follow the Sala Monster on Twitter at Sala Monster.
Sala Monster.
Solo Monster.
Sala Monster Sounds Off.